Welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk about the Kingdom of God. The Kingdom of God has been around from the beginning. It is composed of those people who are ruled by God. How are they ruled? Well, they're ruled in their hearts by God. And occasionally men can participate in an activity which will bar them from the liberty of acting according to their good conscience. They literally can bind themselves by agreements so that they do not have the power or the right any longer to exercise their good conscience without some sort of restrictive power penalizing or controlling them. We call these agreements covenants, contracts, compacts, and constitutions. We call them many things, but basically they are agreements that are binding. That is the fundamental, intrinsic nature of these things we call covenants and contracts. They are agreements that are binding. In almost every case, there is a certain something from one individual or group of individuals that is granted to another individual or group of individuals. There is also an aspect of limiting power and authority. If you have a right and a power to decide something, and you give that power of choice to someone or some group of men, you have literally given it. If you do so in exchange for something, then that giving becomes binding. You can't just take it back, especially if you've received this something and consumed it. If you want your right back, now you must do what? You must pay back that which you have taken and consumed. Otherwise, you're a thief. You've made a bargain, you've made an agreement, and you must keep to that agreement or suffer the consequences of violating that agreement, which is sometimes included in the contract. This is a discussion that we have often here discussing this covenant of God, the covenant with the inhabitants where we go, the covenants with their gods, these binding oaths, these applications for benefits, these tables that are a snare, and they are all talked about in Old and New Testament alike, and it is something that very few people address, very few ministers address within the congregations of the people that they serve and are supposed to be preaching the kingdom to. We know that in Jeremiah 31:31 through 34, we have read, "I will put my laws in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and will be their God." That's their ruling judge. "And they shall be my people." You will actually belong to God, not to any other gods, but only to God, not to the inhabitants where you go. You will belong to God, and you will exercise your free choice under God. "And they shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' for they shall all know me, from the least of them unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more." Now that's back in the Old Testament in Jeremiah. And they're talking about God remembering their sin no more, that they will be redeemed, that they will not be subject to any other gods but God the Father, and that every man won't be telling his neighbor what to do and what not to do. He will not be setting rules and limitations as to what you can give and what you will get back and when you will be charitable and when you will be in receipt of things. Of course, that doesn't mean that we don't have power and dominion over some things. I mean, if someone is messing with my family, I should have the right to say, stop. I can do that kind of directing, but I can't go into his family and tell him what he can do with his family, what he must teach his children, how he must grant charity to this cause or that cause. I can't force him to do that and call myself a Christian. I have to give him the right, and actually I don't give it to him, God gave it to him, but I must permit him the right of choice. You can only be as free as you are willing to let other men be free. But of course, that isn't mean free to do actual damage and harm. We're talking about free to make choices based on faith, hope, and charity. But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry. That's what we're told in the Bible. That word ministry is liturgia. It is actually where we get words like liturgy. But the excellent ministry, we think, oh, well, that has to do with, you know, church and prayer meetings and things like that that we conduct in these churches on the street corner. But the Greek word actually means a public office which a citizen undertakes to administer at his own expense his ministry. In other words, it's not just a public office like you see in the governments of the Gentiles, where he ministers his public office and his services at the expense of the people. People have to contribute to his ministry. That's the way governments of the world operate. But Christ's kingdom is not of the world, and it doesn't operate that way. Its ministers undertake the administration of the service to the congregation, or public if you want to call them that, but at his own expense. And the individual people have the right to choose whether or not they wish to contribute to that public office or ministry of that minister. That is the key distinction we often see on the surface of God's kingdom and the other governments of the other nations. They don't rely upon their power to administer at their own expense, but rather at the expense of their neighbor. But that quote goes on to say, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon a better promise. For if that first covenant had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second. For finding fault with them, he saith, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. So we know that this new covenant was coming about, and of course that's exactly what Christ did when he told the Pharisees, I'm going to take the kingdom away from you, and I'm going to give it to somebody else who bears fruit. Now he specifically said that he was going to take the kingdom away. So we have to take Jesus at his word that he did this, and that the kingdom was already there. And what was the kingdom doing? Well, it was becoming a part of the world of Pontius Pilate, the world of Rome, the constitutional order of Rome. And that's something we constantly keep coming back to, is that Christ was saying that his kingdom was not of this world, but he never said it wasn't on this planet. The word world there means constitutional order. It has to do with the system. And he was talking to who? Pontius Pilate. And who was Pontius Pilate? He was the procurator of Rome. He was the judge sitting in the judgment seat when Jesus said, my kingdom's not of this world, meaning this court, this constitutional order of Rome. We've made no treaties with you. No lawful treaties have been made. And of course, at that time, Rome had not yet conquered Judea. It had been invited in, yes. It had a great deal of influence, mostly commercial, yes. It had a military presence, but Israel had an army still. Israel had a system of courts. Israel had its own system of daily ministration, taking care of the widows and orphans. It was a government. It was functioning on a regular basis. And yes, Rome was usurping a little bit of authority that it probably shouldn't, but it shouldn't have been invited in to begin with. And in fact, its invitation that it was relying upon to be there was not a legal invitation. And now you have Christ, who's been proclaimed king by thousands of people. He's already gone in and fired the money changers, something only the king was allowed to do according to Judaic law. And that had been that way since way back at the time of David. Only he could fire the money changers. And Jesus is doing this. I mean, he's seen in the royal treasury, instructing the ministers. He is the king. He's giving orders that vessels aren't to be carried around. In other words, funds aren't to be shifted from one point in the temple to another. This was a government building. There was a huge system of welfare operating out of here. There were temple guards, which would amount to from the Secret Service to the FBI. I mean, they were the government police. They are the state police. And they could arrest you, they could take you in and try you, because this was a government. This wasn't some street corner church that has choir practice on Wednesday. This was the government of Judea, and Jesus was walking around in there doing the things that only the king could do because everyone was saying he was the king. Yes, there was an opposition party. There was the Pharisees and the Sadducees. These were actually political parties, and they were not happy with the decisions that Jesus Christ was making, because Jesus was taking them back to the law that they were in violation of. Now, was he going back to the law of Moses? He was going back to the law of God that Moses told us about. I'm not talking about all the specific statutes. We will get into that some other place. I'm talking about the basic laws of free will offerings, of the way in which they chose the ministers, the way in which they chose their judges and courts. There's an actual very specific way in which this was done, and the Pharisees had turned this all the way around. Herod had been a part of that. The Hasmoneans had been a part of that. They had changed things. And again, we've read Jeremiah, but then if you go into Hebrews 8:6, we see, not according to the covenants that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand and led them out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant, and I regard them not, saith the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people, and they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for all shall know me, from the least to the greatest. For I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. Again, the same message is repeated in Old and New Testament, because God is the same today as he was yesterday. He hasn't changed one bit. Yes, we're not going to end up looking just like the Pharisees and the Sadducees, because they weren't doing what they were supposed to. How did they get away with doing what they were not supposed to? Because they had twisted the pens of the scribes. They had distorted the original message until it was almost unrecognizable. And that's very important to understand. A lot of people say, oh, well, these are the Jews over here or over there in Israel, for an example. But their government looks nothing like what Moses set up. It's completely different government. Oh, they got some of the robes, and they got, you know, some of the buildings, and they speak in Hebrew, and they make lots of references to the Torah. But are they really forming a government like that which Moses set up according to the leading of God the Father? Well, no, they don't. And we can debate that some other time, but it doesn't really take much figuring out if you understand how that original government worked way back for that first 400 years after Moses. And very few people do, because they're often relying on this interpretation and twisting of that original text. I'm not saying the original text is wrong, but the way in which it's interpreted often is wrong. And so therefore they come up with systems of governance that are in conflict with what Moses was teaching. But that's not the topic today. We'll go on here, look at Matthew 21:43. Therefore say I unto you, the kingdom of God shall be taken from you and given to a nation bringeth forth the fruits thereof. Now what nation was that? Well, it was the nation. What's a nation? Let's ask that. They talk about nation. They talk about government. They talk about different concepts with these different words, and they make them as if they are all synonymous. Well, a nation basically is a people. A country is basically a land. A government is basically a system by which people live on the land. So we may use the word, I'm from this country, or I am a member of the American nation, or I'm a citizen of the United States. Well, these may not all be exactly the same thing, because we have these different nuances of these words, country, nation. And what it says in here is he's talking about taking the kingdom of God from one group of people and giving it to another group of people, another nation, that will bear fruit. And who did he give it to? We all know who he gave it to. He told us who. In Luke 12:32, "Fear not, little flock, for this is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." He's telling you right out. He's talking to who he's going to give it to, the little flock, which is at least the 12 apostles. We know there was at least 70 more people that were following him. We know there was 120 names at the time of the upper room that had come into some kind of an accord with these 12 apostles. This accord was not unlike a constitution. They were coming into an accord according to the teachings of Jesus Christ, a king who had said in Luke 22:29, "And I appoint unto you a kingdom as my Father hath appointed unto me." So you see there that Christ taking the kingdom away from people like the money changers, taking charge in the temple, then appointing his apostles as the new ministers of his kingdom with certain limitations and restrictions, which are written clearly in the Bible. They were not to be like the governments of the Gentiles. They were not to be like the princes of the governments of the Gentiles who call themselves benefactors, but exercise authority. So the apostles were benefactors, in a sense, of this kingdom that Jesus is appointing them, but they could not exercise authority, like the Pharisees, who were collecting the freewill offerings at the point of the spears of the temple guards. If you did not give your freewill offering and the scribe checked off your name, there would be guards knocking on your door, saying, you know, time to contribute. And this had come in slowly. It started way back with, well, it started almost immediately, but, you know, it was pushed back during the time of Nehemiah, and then it grew again during other times. But basically, about 160 B.C., we see the Hasmoneans changing little things in the nature of the government of Judea. And then we see also about 78 B.C. that they made certain taxes or certain contributions at the temple mandatory. We see Herod bringing in a system of Corban where you signed up for this system of Social Security. You were baptized into what he was calling the Kingdom of Heaven. And then you had an annual stipends that you had to pay into the temple. If you became blind or were injured or couldn't take care of yourself, you fell on the charity of the temple. And the temple had this huge treasury in order to fund these programs of charity offered by Herod's temple. And they called that program Corban. Now, Corban, if you take that word way back in history, and we won't go all into it in great detail, but if you take that word back in history, you'll find it. The Romans had a similar word. They spelled it with a Q-U, but it was Corban. And you'll find it in the Quran even has a word Corban. Of course, we see them using the letter K, I think they use, for Corban in some translations. But the point is, Corban is an offering. It's an offering that is to be laid on the altars of the temple. Well, Corban in ancient Israel was a free will offering. Over and over again, we see that term, free will offering. You choose to give it. But somewhere along the line, through the Hasmoneans, through the Pharisees, through Herod, and through the participation in social programs set up by men like Herod and some of the others like Hyrcanus, the Israelites were now bound and compelled to contribute. If your name was on the roster, and they came back and they would say, "Are you one of the ones who contribute? Is your name on the roster?" Well, if your name was on the roster, yes, you had to contribute. And these people were bound in these systems. And their agreements and their applications for these benefits really became a part of the constitution of Judea. And they were no longer free souls under God. They had other gods before them. These other gods are the ruling judges who could come in and not arbitrate, but arbitrarily say, "You owe this amount. You owe that amount. We don't think you're paying what you should pay. And we're going to send soldiers down there and arrest you, confiscate your property, etc., etc." And this was all going on. They had Gabbai, was one of the tax collectors that was used by them in those days. And this was becoming oppressive. it wasn't just the Romans. It was Judean government that was oppressive. But business was good and it was working out pretty well. But some people found, I don't like the way this is going. I want something different. And out of the wilderness, there was this guy, John the Baptist, who was teaching a different kingdom of heaven, different than the one that Herod and his ministers were preaching. His kingdom said, if you have two coats and your neighbor doesn't have any, share. His kingdom was operating on charity. It was still well organized, it was networked, and got even better organized under Christ and his apostles and the 120 and the people that came out from there. Later on, they were electing men like Stephen, and they had their overseers, which were the apostles, making sure that these offices were carried out and the daily administration of that government was taken care of. There are a lot of misconceptions about what was going on back then, but this is why the Christians were not liked, is they no longer contributed to the religious plans of taking care of widows and orphans. We have to remember that always, that religion, pure religion, is the taking care of widows and orphans and the needy. That's what it says in the Bible. That's the only time it talks about religion in a good sense. It says pure religion is doing that. Well, Herod had a system to do this, and it's a good idea to have a system to do this. But one aspect of his system was to compel the contributions of the people, to sign up and become a member. And when you did, you became a resource for that funds, but you also became entitled to receive the benefits. But Christ said that system of Corban made the law to no effect. He warned the people that Corban, those who cry Corban and make the law to no effect, the law is according to the perfect law of liberty. You must maintain the right to choose to contribute. That's primary. Secondary is you must contribute. You must be a part and play the aspect of God's government that each individual is burdened with, which we call responsibility. Responsibility and rights are bound together. You cannot have your rights without having exercised on a regular basis your responsibility. If you stop exercising your responsibilities, you will lose your rights. They go hand in hand. So that gives you a brief idea of how Christ's government worked. There's a great deal more to it. It's all in the biblical text. You simply have to look beyond what you are being shown and look for yourselves, like the Bereans, and look deeper into the text. And we have a lot of information on this, and we're going to cover a lot of this, but we're going to talk more about the idea of constitutions. Now, I live in America, and the most predominant constitution that we find in America today is the federal or United States Constitution of America. Now, each state has a constitution. Lots of other entities have compacts and agreements. Other groups like churches have accords. We call it different things. But those are the basic fundamentals of government. We know that the church is a government. Whenever we use that word government, people immediately think some kind of ruling authority, because they're used to thinking government, power. Government, authority. Government, rules. Government, laws. Government, enforcement. But that isn't necessarily how it works. There are governments that operate on the perfect law of liberty. Doesn't mean they don't have laws. It just means that men can't make law for you. The law is pretty basic. You know, don't steal, don't murder. And actually, if you want to break it down into real fundamentals, stealing and murdering are the same thing. You're taking something that you don't have a right to. Take a man's life, we could call it. That's murder. To take a man's life without just cause, what we're talking about is murder. You don't have the right to murder people. You don't have a right to steal their stuff or their life. You don't have a right to take their wife or their children or their property. So now we're getting up into the 9th and 10th commandments. You don't have a right to injure them. Injury is a way of taking away. You know, if you smash a guy's car or smash a guy's reputation, you have stolen something from him. You stole his reputation. You don't have his reputation in your pocket, but your lies have stolen his reputation. So stealing, murder, lying, coveting your neighbor's goods, coveting your neighbor's wife, committing adultery, those are all the same exact event. By putting them in these different commandment order, you know, line and putting numbers in front of them, we categorize them. We itemize them. We can clarify them by these descriptions. But it's all basically the same thing, is that we are exercising dominion in a jurisdiction, which is our neighbor's, that we have no right to do. We don't have a right to do that. Our rights, our jurisdiction, is in our own lives, and his jurisdiction is in his own life. And one of the dangers of compacts, contracts, and covenants is that we co-mingle jurisdictions, and we take some of our jurisdiction and we give it to a leader, or we bind ourselves together into a common purse of rights. The Bible tells us the common purse runs towards death. And so these are what happen when we make these agreements with the inhabitants where we go and with their gods. And that's why we're warned over and over again not to do it. And how do we do that again? Applications. When we apply and accept these gifts from the tables of these leaders, these rulers, we bind ourselves in a snare, in a trap, and we lose access to our rights that were given to us by God, because the obligations we create are superseding our access to practice or exercise our rights. We can't do this because we're busy fulfilling an agreement we made with somebody else. And we've given people power, and we can't just take it back because we've exchanged that power for gifts, gratuities, and benefits. So we've kind of gone over that and over that, and I hope everybody is getting a grasp on that. Now let's talk about constitutions in the modern time. So in talking about constitutions, we should start talking about the American Constitution and the U.S. Constitution and all the constitutions that existed in America from 1600 on. Yes, that's right. There are many constitutions. Some of them are called Articles of Confederation. That's literally a form of constitution. They call it a confederation because of the fact that the different members, which were the different colonies, which were actually states at that time, formed this confederation, and it was not as binding as the Constitution could become. Now, the Constitution is a compact between the states, basically, but we often hear this term, we the people, and we think that means that we're all parties to the Constitution, because it says we the people, but we may not be, or we may be, okay, depending on other conditions and other circumstances. And now that's what we're going to look at here for the next half hour, is what is the party of the first part and the party of the second part in the contract we call the Constitution of the United States. In colonial America, it is said the ordinary citizen living on his farm, owned in fee simple, untroubled by any relics of feudalism, untaxed, save by himself, saying his say to all the world in town meetings, had gained a new self-reliance, wrestling with his soul and plow on weekdays, and the innumerable points of the minister's sermon on Sunday and meeting days, he was becoming a tough nut for any imperial system to crack. Now that's from James Truslow Adams, who wrote The History of the United States, and that's from Volume 1, if anybody wants to look it up. That's a fairly comprehensive history of the United States. It's not necessarily what I would say is the best, but I always like that particular quote. There's so many different aspects there. The people are arguing with the minister's points on his sermon. In other words, the ministers didn't just come and dictate to these men what to believe. They wrestled with these ideas and thoughts, and the minister was bringing things up, and he might not agree with them. He was very self-reliant. He had his town meetings. He was untaxed, save by himself. All relics of feudalism had gone aside. He was living on land, and the term here is fee simple. That term is used a number of different ways, and I wouldn't say that was the best choice, but that's what James uses in this particular text. But he was the ordinary citizen living on his own land, untaxed. That's because he actually owned it. And there's a whole story about ownership of land and everything, but we're going to go on further and concentrate on this idea of this constitution and where it all came from. An absolute or fee simple estate is one in which the owner is entitled to the entire property with unconditional power of disposition during his life and descending to his heirs and legal representatives upon his death, intestate. Now, is that the kind of ownership you have over your property? Actually not. Everybody is taxed on their property. They can't even build a garage on their property without asking somebody else for permission. If they inherit the property, they will have to pay a large sum of money, usually to the government, as an inheritance tax, depending on where they live, and a number of other things. So it is not unconditional power of disposition during their life and the descendants to his heirs and legal representatives. It is very conditional ownership. These people, they possess not only the title to the land, but the beneficial interest, the true and actual title. They were called freemen. The definition of freemen meaning someone who is a possessor of allodial lands. That goes way back in history, but you can still find that in dictionaries like the Oxford Dictionary today, that a freeman is someone who actually owns land, not merely a legal title that carries with it no beneficial interest, but actually holds the beneficial interest in his own personal estate. There's also, besides land itself, there's labor, for as labor cannot produce without the use of land, the denial of the equal rights to the use, that's the beneficial use, of land is necessarily the denial of the right of labor to its own produce. And that was why it was so important to the early Americans to own land. They didn't come over here for free land, but land that was free from taxation. And there's a huge history of that. It's been steadily deleted from the history books, from high school history books and college history books. I've actually watched, looking at older history books, I was collecting them and reading different ones, and I was noticing, well, they don't mention this anymore, and they don't mention that anymore. And they make a big deal about this, which wasn't even mentioned in the earlier history books. And I realized that they're drawing you a different picture so that the Americans viewed history in a different way. In Lansing versus Smith, we see people of a state are entitled to all the rights which formerly belonged to the king by his prerogative. In other words, the people in early America, even before the Constitution, were obtaining the rights of a king, and their homes were their castle because they actually owned the land. There was a huge conflict. Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys and this idea of tenure ownership of land untaxed was a critical point to the Americans in the so-called American Revolution. People of America did not revolt. It was the king that revolted. The Declaration of Independence was not a revolution against the king, but an itemized statement of the revolution that the king was imposing upon the people. He was usurping authority that was not his. He was crossing the line of the Ten Commandments. He was taking from the people something they had earned, something that they had a right to, and he did not have a right to. There were arguments actually in the Parliament that the king could not impose some of the restrictions and taxes on the Americans that he was trying to impose. It was said that he could do it anywhere else in the kingdom of Great Britain, but he couldn't do it in America because something else had gone on before the American Revolution that was already setting the people free. They were becoming free men because they owned land, something that wasn't going on anymore for the average subject citizen in England. It had been there before 1066, but it had been dissipated out of existence through huge numbers of conflicts over a period of about 500 years. and now in America that freedom was coming about. The question that Cecil B. DeMille asks in the Ten Commandments, are men the property of the state, or are they free souls under God? This same battle continues throughout the world today. That is right. It does continue throughout the world. And we experience it, but we have become oblivious to this conflict in many ways because we have been drugged by an artificial affluence based on debt. And we have been lied to, we have been misled, we have been told of Santa, and now someone is coming along and saying, there ain't no Santa Claus in America. There is no free giveaway. You want your rights, you must take back the responsibilities in all aspects of your life. The Constitution will not protect you. Judge Leonard Hand wrote in The Spirit of Liberty that I often wonder whether we do not rest our hopes too much upon the constitutions. Constitutions, he says, upon laws and courts. These are false hopes, believe me. Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. And of course, this is what Christ was telling you, that he is going to write his laws not upon books. I mean, where is the real scripture of God? It's written in the hearts and minds of those who will receive it. Now, yes, there are people who say, oh yeah, I'm hearing God and God is guiding me. And they're lying. And they are not being guided by God. But there are those who are receiving the messages of God in their hearts and in their minds. Hopefully not hearing voices or anything, but they know it. By faith, they look and they say, this is just. This is unjust. This is right. This is not right. This is what I must do to be what I believe God wants me to be. And they're right. And other people are thinking, oh, well, we have to do this or that in order to appear to be right. And they're wrong. But God knows who they are. And if we know God, we will know who they are because we will be able to judge them by their fruits. And so that's the process of growing and seeking the kingdom, is seeking that place where we are humble enough to let God write his laws upon our hearts. And he wants us to be set free and at liberty. Samuel Adams stated on August 1st, 1776, within 1 month of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, our union is complete, our Constitution composed, established, and approved. You are now the guardians of your own liberty. He's putting the responsibility on you, but he said the Constitution is already composed. That's 1776. That's back in August 1st, 1776. We may justly address you as the decemviri did the Romans and say nothing that we propose can pass into law without your consent. Be yourselves, O Americans, the author of those laws on which your happiness depends. Well, if you are giving consent to programs offered to you by authoritarian benefactors, you are not the author of those laws, but you become the author of those laws in the sense that you consent to them. They weren't law for you until you consented to them. Many programs the government offers are voluntary programs. Many of the benefits they offer, which you may indulge in, are voluntary. Once you eat of that table, you may be snared into an agreement and become a party to that constitution which allowed them to offer those benefits. And so that's how it works, is that you give this consent. He says the Constitution was already written in 1776. Well, of course, that's not the United States Constitution. We can go on reading Thomas Paine's Common Sense. Where, say some, is the King of America? I'll tell you, friend, he reigns above and doth not make havoc of mankind like the royal brute in Great Britain. Yet that we may not appear to be defective even in earthly honors, let a day be solemnly set apart for proclaiming the charter. Let it be brought forth, placed on divine law, the word of God. Let a crown be placed thereon, by which the world may know that so far as we approve of monarchy, that in America the law is king. For as in absolute governments the king is law, so in free countries the law ought to be king, and there ought to be no other. But lest any ill use should afterwards arise, let the crown at the conclusion of the ceremony be demolished and scattered amongst the people where right it is. In other words, we must let God write His laws upon our hearts and upon our minds, and we must become that law of justice and mercy. Far too often in our modern day, we have developed, actually we haven't, but somehow or other this institution that was created by the Constitution of the United States and by the constitutions of the many states or the separate states, those create bodies and these men begin to make laws. And there's always a question, do they have the power to make this law? Do they have the power to make that law? And of course we argue that point occasionally, and we're supposed to only argue it before the Supreme Court, who will decide whether or not that law is law or not. But really, the making of the law seems to be completely out of the hands of the individual person. That's not what Thomas Paine is talking about. It wasn't really what Samuel Adams was talking about. He was talking about the basic law being in the hands of the people, and they have to decide the facts and law of every dispute and case. And of course, that's what we did with the jury system at one time in America, even before the Constitution. If you even go back far enough in England, you will see the jury had the right to decide fact and law. And not only the one bringing the action, the prosecutor or whatever it is bringing the action before the jury, but the one who is defending before the jury has a right to participate in the choice of who the jury will be. He actually participates in the choice of who the jury will be, and then the arbitration of the dispute goes to the jury, and the jury decides fact and law. American juries today are not really American juries, they're state or U.S. juries, and they are administrative juries, and they do not have the right to decide the law. As a matter of fact, they even take an oath, which is not a very Christian activity because we were told not to do that, but they take an oath that they will decide this case according to the laws of the state of so-and-so. So the state of whatever, Oregon, Connecticut, whatever, has already determined what the law is. The judge is sitting there not simply as a bipartisan arbitrator, but he actually is representing the state. He's going to instruct the jury as to what that law is. And they're only going to decide the facts of the case within the limits that he allows them, because he won't even let them see all the facts of the case. He will keep facts of the case away from them. And I'm not saying that's illegal. I'm just saying that's a different kind of court than originally was here in America. It certainly is a different kind of court than was in Europe and England throughout much of the first millennium after Christ. It is a different kind of court than was in Israel for 400 years before they began to choose kings for themselves. So you have to put this into context. If somebody says court, judge, all judges are not the same, all courts are not the same, all juries are not the same. Some juries have the right to decide fact and law, some juries do not. And again, we go back to Judge Leonard Hand, who is telling us that if liberty lies not in the hearts of men and women, it will die in the country. No matter what safeguards you create, it will die. But it is the responsibility of the people to see to justice. And when we encourage people, when there's injustice going on, people are being dragged into these administrative courts and they're having children taken away, their land taken away, actually sometimes imprisoned. I've seen people in prison based on evidence that was never presented in court. The attorneys knew that it was never presented in court. The judge knew it had never been presented in court because the attorney stood up and said they don't even know what he's talking about. And the judge decided the case based on a letter that the judge received, but none of the attorneys or the defendant received, and the defendant was sent off to jail. You know, what do you do? You say, well, he should file a complaint. Well, you have to remember he's just been stripped of all of his property. He's lost everything fighting this court case to begin with. He is all alone, and most people are home watching TV. They didn't come down to that court case. Now, we had had groups come down to that court case a number of times. This guy, I don't believe he ever committed any crime whatsoever. He never actually was tried. This was only hearings. This guy is doing jail time based on no trial before a jury ever. That happens commonly in America. Don't think it doesn't happen. You don't know the rules of how the system is working. That happens very easily. But anyway, he was sent away to jail based on evidence that never appeared in court. He never got to see his lawyer, never got to see, and his lawyer stood up in court and said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I've never seen a letter." And the judge said, well, there was a letter. And the tapes of the trial, those statements did not appear. They were erased. That happens regularly in courts. It happens because the people are apathetic. They're not interested in doing anything. Children are taken away, property taken away, businesses taken away. Other men get rich. The weak get beat up and thrown into the ditch. And nobody's there to take them out. Because you think that the only criminals go around with masks and guns? You know, most of the robbery done in America is not done at the point of a gun. Most of the stealing goes on through other means, much, much different than armed robbery. But anyway, we'll look at some of those things at another time. We'll continue on with this. James Madison said, "I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachment of those powers than by violent and sudden usurpations." That's right. And that's exactly where we're at today. Slowly things have changed in the courts. I was in courtrooms, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, or actually even more than that, I guess now. My father was an attorney. I went into courtrooms with him. I sat there and watched the proceedings. I talked to him about the law. He actually quit the law because of the corruption that he constantly ran into, but it was the only thing he knew, so he went back, and we actually moved from one state to another state because he was so fed up with the corruption in Texas that he moved to California, but then found a great deal of corruption there, but he would never become a member of a firm again because he knew that by becoming that member, you become a part and parcel party to the things that that firm did. And he just found too much corruption in it all. And he would not ever become a member of a law firm again. But it's this gradual changing, the old story of the frog, heating things up. And he just keeps sitting there, until somebody, you know, he's cooked. You're cooking the frog 1 degree at a time. And that's really what's happened. A lot of people think, oh, it's not bad. You know, they hear, oh, well, there's corruption here. But then we read about it in the paper and they did something about it. They don't know what they did about it, but they assume they did something about it. But families are being destroyed left and right by the abuses within the court systems of America. There's also police brutality. Is every cop brutal? No, absolutely not. Some of them are great guys, brave, sincere men who are seeking justice for everybody. But not all of them. And actually, I've talked to my next-door neighbor, who's an ex-sheriff. I was seeking a career in law enforcement and carried a badge and a gun for a while myself. But he says the caliber of the men that we're getting today is completely different than when he was a young officer and when he was a sheriff. Something's changing in this gradual encroachment, this change of opinion. And it doesn't just start in the police force or in the courts, it starts way back in the schools. Our view of history has changed. Our view of morality has changed. And view of morality has changed. That's an understatement. I mean, look at TV. It is just constantly being bombarded. And young people are growing up who are going to be terribly affected by all of this. Almost out of time here. So this is prior to the 14th Amendment. No private person has a right to complain by suit in court on ground of breach of Constitution. The Constitution, it is true, is a compact, but he is not a party to it. The states are a party to it. That's the Supreme Court of Georgia and Paterford versus the city of Savannah. But that's true, and we'll talk more about that. We'll have to look at it at another time, but that is something that we need to examine, is who is this party of the first part, party of the second part, in this contract we call the Constitution? I mean, a few years ago, that was a big political theme. Contract with America. But, of course, God told us not to make contracts with the inhabitants or with their ruling judges. They're gods. That's what ruling judges are. That's what gods are. They're ruling judges. The Emperor of Rome was called a god. Why? Because he appointed all the gods throughout the empire. Who were these gods? Well, these were the judges in the courts of law. That's what you call them. If you look in your Strong's Concordance, everywhere, when you use the word God, it means ruling judge. And it comes from the same word that was used every day at the time of Christ to address judges in courts of law, both in the Hebrew and in the Greek, because that's what they are. And we're not supposed to be making covenants with them. And yet they're saying here that prior to the 14th Amendment, we were not a party to that Constitution. No individual was. So how did we become a party to the Constitution if we are today? Until then, may peace be on your house and God bless you.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.